Welcome to Designed for More, brought to you by Common Reason Ministries and Honey Lake Clinic. Join Dr. Timothy Jennings, a renowned expert in psychiatry, neuroscience, and spiritual well-being, as he explores the connections between mind, body, spirit, and relationships.
Hello, and welcome to Designed for More, sponsored by Common Reason Ministries and Honey Lake Clinic. I'm Dr. Tim Jennings, and I'm joined today by Danielle Rome, one of our therapists, and James Johnson, our chief chaplain here at the clinic. And we have a very special guest today joining us because we're going to be talking about the intersection of social media and adolescent young people's mental health. And we're joined today by Katie McPherson. And Katie, we're so glad that you're joining us today. And why don't you, before we get into the topic, just tell us a little about yourself and your background and you know what you have done on this topic.
Yeah, I really got interested in this. I was a school administrator for teacher, counselor, administrator for 22 years. So I watched middle school and high school students start to use this all the way back in 1999. So I've been watching sort of this intersection of how childhood has changed the impact on their brains and their mental health. I'm also a mother of four teenage girls who are currently 16, 16, 17, and 18. So I'm parenting through this as well.
What have you seen as a teacher, as a mother, over the last 20 years or so on how social media, digital media, and then the devices we have, are you seeing something that raises concerns for you in relationship to the mental health of our families and young people?
Absolutely. I mean, I remember vividly like 2007 through 2016 was really when I just saw such a marked difference in my students, the anxiety, the depression. I remember students walking into my office in 2012 with cuts on their arms. And I was like, what is going on? What is this? It was self-harm wasn't something I had been trained in. It wasn't something teachers had seen before. That has escalated. That is just sort of the norm now. And just this overall sense of like having to keep up with each other, the comparison to each other, the need to have followers and likes and validation from this outside source. And, you know, as a mom watching my girls go through things that are typical in in-person interactions, but like being excluded from, I wasn't invited to that party. And then there's a photo on Instagram or a boy I like was speaking to me, and now I see him in a photo on Instagram at the ice cream store with another girl. Like these things that maybe parents don't think too much about when they think about this topic, but the impact that it has on these tiny hearts and brains.
As you're describing this, I'm already hearing two different potential paths we want to explore. One is the impact of the content that they're seeing on their sense of self, their social value and worth. It sounds like you're describing that what they're seeing, not getting invited, and et cetera, is having a negative impact on how they are being reinforced positively or negatively in their social perceived social world rather than the objective real social world. That's one. And then as we unpack this, maybe also talk, is there a neurobiological consequence? Is something happening to their brains differently? Are their brains learning to process information differently because of these media and so forth? What are your thoughts about those two pathways?
Yeah, I mean, the dependency that they have on that validation shapes their day, shapes minute to minute. Our schools are allowing these devices during the school day, specifically at the high school. They're starting to mitigate that K through eight, but the high school principals and superintendents and districts, I speak to them often about why are we allowing this during the school day.
And what do they tell you when you ask them, what is the answer they give back as to why they're allowing it?
They're afraid of parents. They're afraid that parents will go ballistic. They're afraid that parents will say, what if there's a school shooting? And so it's just easier to allow it and hope for the best.
And then so what do you tell either the parents or the schools as to why they shouldn't allow it?
I really point to data. I love data.
Well, share some of the data with us.
Yeah. So, you know, when I'm having this conversation with upper leadership, it's about, I would like you to pull out your discipline referrals, your attendance data, your academic data, you know, who's doing well, who's not doing well, and the number of visits to your nurse. because a lot of kids go to the nurse for stomach and headaches because of something that they got on their phone, a notification, a text, a direct message. When we look at discipline referrals, almost 95% of the time, there's some tie to social media or a text, some sort of electronic communication that started a conflict or cyberbullying or predation or vaping and trading drugs and alcohol in the bathroom at the school. Like, it is nonstop madness. And so when they start to pull that out and they talk to colleagues who have put these devices away for the day, it's a non-starter conversation. Like, you can tell that if you would just put these away for the day, you want to have kids have them before and after school in their backpacks in the off position. When we put these away, kids do better, they feel better, academic engagement goes up, discipline goes down. Everybody, and teachers who are trying to manage this stuff, these poor teachers.
So as you're describing that, is that correlation or causation?
I think both.
I mean, you know, what I mean by correlation is two things can happen at the same time. Doesn't mean they're actually, one is causing the other. I think that you've got me on board. I believe it's causation. But is there data that actually shows that these devices are actually causing these problems?
I think, you know, two books that I would point listeners to, Dr. Jean Twenge, the book iGen, which is a little bit an older release, but then Dr. Jonathan Hyatt out of NYU just released The Anxious Generation, and he has a bunch of data that's very current around students that spend at least 2 hours on social media. That's sort of the sweet spot where we start to see the decline in mental health and some of the things that we've already discussed.
Okay, so what do you see the other aspects of the social media that are the problem that you see as, for instance, the networks of their relationships? Like, and I'm really not up to what kids are into these days. I'm not of that generation. But are there certain programs that are actually much more likely to cause problems? And I guess I'm trying to say, it's not that they're using their device to go to Wikipedia and look up something for a term paper. That's not the problem, is correct?
Yeah. Correct. Yeah, I put screen time in two buckets, digital vegetables, digital candy. So the candy, your TikTok, your Instagram, your Snapchat, your Twitter, you know, your Fortnite, your Among Us, your Call of Duty, your video games, like, all of those have a chat feature. And a lot of the chats, the profanity, the hate speech, the racially driven language, like, it's all of it. I mean, all of it is yuck. And so when you look at the balance, you know, there's a light side to technology. It's amazing. These kids are doing some amazing things on social media. But you look at the dark side, and unfortunately, the dark side, in my opinion, outweighs some of that light side. And it comes down to training. We've literally handed over the Ferrari with no driver's ed. And these kids have been crashing and burning for 25 years. You look at the acuity of the students that are coming forward in schools. I've never seen anything like it. And COVID, you know, I don't have any research studies that I can pull currently to say, like, this actually lobbed on top of that. But we know during COVID, you know, social media was a great connector for some students, but it was also an isolator for others. And so going back to your correlation causation, there's just so many factors in the mix. You have genetics, you have environment, you have protective factors, you have social supports, you have community support. Like, each child is different. But, you know, the research in the newer books, like The Anxious Generation, really points to when we decided to not allow our children to free play and say that the world is scary, come inside, and then hand over video games and devices, we started to see an uptick in mental health issues.
No, I think this is a great book you've referenced. He's done a lot of really good work. I've read the book, and I think he's right on track with this. And so for our audience, what's generally described in the book is that as a child's brain is developing, they're trying to balance the two general motivators to life, the positive exploration of one's environment, which is that discovery aspect that can bring excitement, versus the survival network when there's threat and danger to avoid the exploration, stay in a safe place. In that, as children have unsupervised play in the real world, they're constantly adjusting this balance between exploration and moving forward in their life versus restraint and staying safe. And examples they give would be, you know, you put some kids out in the in their yard to play with a skateboard, and at first it's just learning how to balance, but pretty soon the kids start ratcheting up the danger level. Somebody holds a rope and says, pull me, and the centrifugal force, and they get increasing speed, and then they'll put a jump in. They keep ratcheting up the danger level, the danger level, as they get more competent, and that gives them more excitement. And then what will happen is eventually there's a fall, there's a scrape, there's an injury. They go in and they cry, they got hurt, and they stop playing for a little while. But then they reflect on that and they go, yeah, that hurt, but it was worth it. Let's go out and do it again. And they'll go out and play again. And so they're learning how to adjust this. And he makes the argument that in this era of digital world, the kids are not getting that built-in natural real-world wiring of this risk-reward kind of balance, because they're actually acting through avatars in a digital world where they actually don't suffer any injury. And then when they go out into the world, rather than seeing opportunities for advancement and discovery, they see threats and danger, and they need everything protected, and they need safe spaces. That's kind of the general philosophy that he's kind of describing in the book. Would you agree?
Yeah, absolutely. And there's some stats in there about boys in particular, which we've spoken about before in the past, just the risk-taking that's not going on. He had some stat in there that, you know, broken bones have gone down 60% for boys 10 and under. And certainly we don't want kids breaking bones, but the risks that they're not taking by not playing and having those interactions that you're having, that mirroring of each other, and, you know, going back to the phones at lunchtime. The last place I want a kid at lunchtime is on a phone. I want them socializing and looking at each other and building vocabulary and learning how to self-advocate if they're being excluded at the lunch table. You know, the high school principals will say, you know, well, we're going to allow the phones not during class time, but during passing period and lunch. Those are the times that I want kids being kids and learning how to interact with each other.
Yeah. Do you guys have any questions or thoughts about this?
Well, you know, as a father of teenage girls as well, thank you for sharing this. I'm grateful for the insights. And one of the things that we have not done is we have not allowed our girls to have social media accounts yet, but they want them. You know, their friends have them. And we've talked about some of these dangers. But one of the things that I am really nervous about is this idea of self-image, you know, the way they see themselves compared to other people. And, you know, as a person who knows this realm and who's available, what tips would you give for parents like me as their children do begin to enter this digital space? You know, Harvard's done a lot of studies showing that excessive social media use has a negative impact on body image and self-value. What are some of the things that contribute to that in your perspective, as far as like as our children start to engage in that so we can create some protective factors?
Yeah, I think the best thing is to do it with them, meaning if you're going to give it, you have to know it backwards and forwards. I hear all the time from parents like, well, I don't really understand Snapchat. They want it. They're, you know, pecking at me like a hen. They have to have it. And I just gave it because I didn't understand it. And now I hear it's horrible. We can no longer use that excuse. We have all of the data. We have all of the science. So doing it together, I always tell people to think of your child at age 18. And what does it look like between 9 and 18 and teaching them how to use these digital tools? And so if and when you give social media, whether it's 15, 16, 17, 18, and the recommendation from the CDC, the Surgeon General, and Dr. Height is 16. So what does it look like between, let's say, 14 and 18 when we're doing this together? If you're going to have one social media platform, I would absolutely not recommend Snapchat for any person on the planet. I think it is the worst platform ever. It has so much yuck on it. And not to say that TikTok and Instagram don't. Every single platform allows all of the yuck, the nudity, the fentanyl, the racial slurs. Like, it is every platform. You can find that on Pinterest if you really wanted to. And so really being intentional about how are we going to do this in incremental baby steps? If I'm going to give this, how am I going to monitor and supervise? My day job is with Bark. Bark is an AI app that monitors and supervises these platforms. There's a reason Snapchat doesn't let Bark or any other app in, because they don't want it to be supervised. And so really knowing what you're handing over, there's a wonderful website called protectyoungeyes.com that I point every person to, because he has such great content. It's a faith-based platform. If you want to know anything like how to lock down YouTube settings, what is Snapchat, what is Instagram, having these resources at your fingertips is so important.
Well, another thing that I am finding as I'm getting older is the language, you know, is changing. And that's just every generation, I guess. But as I hear my girls talk about things, I have to always say, what does that mean? What does that mean? And my oldest daughter mentioned something the other day called doom scrolling. And so I had to learn about that. What is that? How does that impact the mind? I guess if you could give us some explanation.
I don't even know what that is.
That's why I was curious to see how, if she would, you know, could give us some insight.
Yes.
Okay. So obviously, you know, yeah. So what is that? What does that do?
What is it?
So I did experience my teenage years with technology. So I have some insights from experience as well of how it progressively has gotten worse. So thankfully in my, well, I guess first I'll comment on doom scrolling.
What is it?
Doom scrolling is, I will say I love the humor of the generation that's on technology. I think it's so funny. But basically it's just when you get in this like totally zoned out, you're not even present of time, what's around you, anything. You're just scrolling and not even conscious of what you're seeing, how long you've been on there. And it's called doom scrolling because you're like going down this
like, and you're the, scrolling like, through like different videos or different content.
Yep. And everyone knows it's bad. Like I've never heard of someone knowing that it's good, but it's similar to people joking about, oh yeah, this bad habit, ha ha ha, it's not that bad, but we all know it's not the best. That's what I've seen and heard. I don't know if that aligns with what you've seen, but
yeah, absolutely. I mean, with the algorithms and the reels, R-E-E-L-S, you know, every platform now has reels where you can just watch one video after the other. And it's like YouTube, it just is scrolling, scrolling, scrolling. And so, you know, if you are watching something like yoga, you're going to be fed yoga videos. If you are watching something like recipes, you are going to be fed recipes. But if you're watching how to cut yourself, you're going to be fed that kind of content. And that's where these kids really go down a rabbit hole that is just so dangerous. And so I don't even have a word for it. It's just awful. It's very dark.
Well, something that maybe our parents in the audience may like to know. I saw a study recently where they evaluated 15-year-olds from 124 countries. So this is worldwide. And the point of that is it's not cultural, it's neurobiological, because the findings were consistent in all 24 countries. And they had them read a paragraph or two of material and then tested them on whether they could tell the difference between facts and opinion. And in the study of 15-year-olds, only 7% could tell the difference between facts and opinion. 93% could not differentiate between fact and opinion. And that parents need to understand what they're letting their kids be exposed to, because, as you know, much of the content, whether it is just a demonstration or declaration, opinion, lots of opinion in social media, but that opinion is not differentiated by 15-year-old brains. By and large. And so they accept that as the way the world is, the way reality is. And then that becomes very damaging, because as we internalize things into our belief system, it formulates and actually changes our neurobiology and affects our moods, affects the filters on how we filter information and life events. And thus, I think there is a direct linkage between what kids are taking in content-wise and what you're seeing in the schools with their disrupted behaviors and inability to stabilize their moods and so forth.
I see it too during certain times, like during the election. I mean, you talk to teachers in areas like ours that have flipped from one party to the other, And you have students who are in high school who have opinions and are taking in the information that you're talking about and can't discern between fact and opinion. And those conversations are happening in the classroom, they're happening in the hallways, they're happening in the locker room, they're happening at the lunch table. And teachers are not trained, and even administrators are not trained to be able to contain sort of that intensity and energy behind certain topics. I live in a border state. We're 4 hours from the border. There are children in our schools that are terrified that ICE is going to come get them and round them up. Our teachers and administrators are not trained to have these conversations about how to calm down a conversation between perhaps a student that thinks they should be deported and a student that might be deported. And so like these topics that they're watching with the intensity and energy behind them, it's very, very difficult for our educators to manage and even for our parents as well.
Interesting. Back to the developing sense of self. In the schools where they're allowing them to use their devices, is it only the external content from these platforms that are the problem? Or in the schools, are they developing social networks where in real time they're, you know, when I was in school, we didn't have any of this stuff, but you had your cliques. And the cliques, the in crowd would you know, gossip about the out crowd and this types of high school cliquish stuff. Is that now happening more intensely with social media because these texts and tweets and maybe somebody takes a picture of somebody in the bathroom and throws it out onto the platform and the whole school knows it in 10 minutes? And I mean, is this kind of stuff happening?
Yeah, I mean, those discipline referrals and those things that I talked about, I got a call last week from a seventh grade mom of a seventh grade boy. He was going to the bathroom inside the stall. Somebody was in the second stall next to him, went over the stall with their phone, put the phone over him and took a video of him going to the bathroom and then shared it during the school day on Snapchat. And his genitalia went around the school and she was sobbing. She was, you know, this is obviously a crime in the state of Arizona to distribute child pornography like that. But what do you do? What do you do as a seventh grade boy and your genitalia has gone around the entire school? You walk out of the bathroom and everyone is making fun of you. I mean, it's just, it's outrageous.
Yeah, yeah. When I was in high school, it was more in the gym class and somebody's on the pull-up bar and somebody yanks their pants down and they drop and pull them up real fast. That, I mean, that happened in high school occasionally.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it's, that stuff happens still.
Yeah, but that is like 2 seconds and it's up and it's done and the whole school didn't get to see it. It seems to me much more potentially devastating to the developing self, where the sense of humiliation and the sense of embarrassment is happening and then the bullying. So that story, I'm imagining a lot of the girls probably have the in click and the out click, and then they probably, you know, do this type of thing, not necessarily with bathroom video, but with other types of uncomplimentary images that they send. Is this happening?
That's happening. And then just like a lower level friendship thing where they will go somewhere together and tag all of the people in the photo except for one person. So they call it, you know, the technical term is sins of omission. So imagine 7 or 8 girls going to a party and everyone is tagged in the photo except for Katie. And so Katie is like, why wasn't I tagged in the photo?
What does tagging mean? For those of us who don't do this, what does it mean to tag?
Yeah.
I hear that and I'm thinking they put their names in the picture. That's probably not what it means.
I'll let your other guest, since she's been through this as with life experience, I'll let her.
Danielle, tell us, what's tagging?
Yeah, basically.
Is it putting their name in the picture?
Well, okay, so I've been off social media for 4 years now, so I don't know what the most recent stuff is. I know on Facebook, it was like you would have someone's name linked over their face. I don't know how it is like on Instagram right now. Is it similarly still?
Yeah.
So it's basically, you're connecting the picture to other people's accounts.
So, all the people's platforms, so they all can now network on that conversation about the picture.
Yeah.
But the one person doesn't get that conversation on their feed.
Yeah. But then they see themselves in the picture and they're thinking, what did I do? This is what I'm hearing.
It's very insidious and very purposeful.
And
girls, as you know, developmentally, like parents freak out, like, why is the friendship group treating my daughter this way? We did this when I was in middle school and high school. We had the in-out groups. We were friends one day and not the next. You know, this push and pull back and forth, which is very developmentally typical. It's hurtful, but it's happened for decades and decades. But this electronic form of it is blatantly in your face, like you were there, but we're not including you. And so it's this extra layer of like poking and ostracization.
Okay, so let's pause on this, because I think this happens a lot. I think anybody that's on the platforms are vulnerable to this type of thing, especially in the adolescent and high school period. Other than taking the device so they're not on an account, that's one way to protect. Mm-hmm. Thoughts amongst us, your daughter, this happens to. What are the interventions other than you can't be on the account? If they are on the account and this has happened, how do we help them handle that in a way that matures them and helps them develop skills rather than wounds them and causes them to isolate? Mm-hmm. Any thoughts about that?
I mean, the first thing that comes to mind is what you were talking about with the skateboard, right? And maybe a progressive allowing of more and more where somebody can learn skills on how to cope, how to process with these kinds of betrayals and conflicts over time instead of being thrown into everything all at once. Because another part of this is there's different almost social expectations for each platform. There's, you know, whereas before it's you learn social skills in real life, but now it's you have to learn a whole new set of interaction rules, how to speak, how to be in all these different ways. And it's also constantly changing. And so there's this anxiety of I'm going to say something wrong, I'm going to post something wrong. And then when you do, all hell breaks loose.
So I really like where you're going with this, Danielle. And I want Katie, you to speak into this as well. But here's what I'm hearing, that first, if and when we allow this, we do it in a graded fashion, not just jump in the deep end.
Yeah.
Parents, as you earlier said, were involved as they get in with this. But you also are suggesting perhaps we do not let the social media world itself define normality, that we do not let them define themselves as the standard of what's right and wrong, that the parent is teaching the child when these things happen, that's evidences of insecurities, problems, whatever it is, and the people who would treat somebody this way, and teach them, and then how do we take that event, it happened, how do we internalize it in a way based on what's true, what's healthy, what's mature, how can we protect one's self from collapse when somebody treats us inappropriately. Now, you notice I said collapse. I think it's normal. If somebody stomped on your foot, the normal response is to be hurt. That's pain. If somebody, the normal response is to be emotionally hurt, that's okay to have the emotional hurt. But how do you then process that in a way that you don't collapse, that you come out of that with some strength, some resilience to be able to handle that moving forward? Katie, what are your thoughts about that?
Well, I wanted to go back to the standard that you talked about. Like, I have four girls. I have this small estrogen tide pool of girls that are looking at what is the standard of beauty? What is the standard of how a young woman looks? And that standard is Kim Kardashian. So there are things that go along with what they see online that they think are acceptable, whether it's fake eyelashes or I have to weigh a certain amount of weight. I mean, I can't tell you how many times I've had the conversation around what is healthy, what is not. Let's look at Instagram. Let's look at some of the things that you're looking at and that standard of baseline of like what's healthy. You know, my girls, I believe that they're all beautiful in their own way, right? But the standard of like beauty just on the front of what you described about sense of self, it is outrageous. I mean, the conversations that they have, the products that are being sold, all of those things. But I also think this incremental trust that we have to build, we have to do this together with our children, which means we have to be current and relevant. And most parents, and I say this with all the grace in the world, most parents are not current and relevant. And so when they're trying to have these conversations with their children about what is appropriate, what is not, don't be hurt by what happened to you, the kids are like, You are from 1973. You have no idea what you're talking about. You don't even have Snapchat or Instagram, so you have no idea what I'm going through. And so I think, you know, for parents to step into this, to really dig in, not only to the research, but really to have these platforms yourself and watch what your children are being fed. Because then when the conversation is more relevant, the child is more open and receptive to that feedback.
This is interesting. Have you seen some of the videos and or resources out there that have gone behind the scenes and exposed the fake that goes into what are considered world-class models and these beauty, these beautiful people who end up the face of these different industries, and they actually walk you back from the photo that ends up on the front of the magazine or in the video, and they walk you back getting that photo ready, both from the digital enhancements that happen to the taping and all the makeup and all the other stuff that happens. And then you actually see that actual physiological model, and it's nothing like what you're seeing. In other words, this is all fake. They're being compared to a fake presentation that's not actually real in the large landscape of reality. And is there a place to help, you know, the young people recognize this is a big lie? It's a big deception.
Well, that's actually not as helpful anymore, because now we don't just have models, we have influencers. So we have 18...
And they're fake too.
But you see this girl in her bedroom taking a video saying, look how pretty I am. Look at this product that you should have. Also, this is why I'm pretty. And so it's even more of an illusion, because it's, oh, this is just a normal girl. This is what normal girls can look like. This is what I should look like. And so it's different. There's not as much of the separation between me and model all the way up here who's famous. It's, this could be me and it's not.
Yeah, the point is this. I think my point still stands. Most of those influences. Now, are there truly the, you know, when you standard deviation, are there some genetically truly gifted individuals that have, they just stand apart physiologically from the, I mean, they're one in 10 million or whatever. Sure, there's occasional individuals. Sure. But the vast majority of these are doing all the same thing. They're enhancing with various cosmetics or other things to actually give a fake presentation of their real self.
Yeah, and plastic surgery.
And plastic surgery
is more accessible now too. So like lip filler is a lot more affordable. It's, you know about this. It's more common for young girls to want lip filler. Kind of it's advertised, oh, well, it naturally dissipates, it naturally goes away. And now that's going out of style. It's slowly starting to end because the styles and expectations are changing way more rapidly than they ever have. And so now there are girls who've spent all this money on the lip filler. It's not dissipating the way that they thought it would. And now what do you do? Now you know, so that's another side of it too, is it's accessible. It's presented as a lot more normal.
So the driver here, though, psychologically, is that these are developing individuals who have a vacuous or undefined sense of self. They're wanting to internalize elements that make them feel good about self.
Mm-hmm.
And then they're being influenced by the external superficial that has no real value, and it doesn't actually bring a healthy peace to one's soul or spirit.
Yeah.
Okay. Is that fair to say? And thus, in other words, what's driving this is fear and insecurity.
Mm-hmm.
Fear of rejection, fear of not being loved, fear of abandonment, fear of being inadequate, fear of being rejected, and wanting to have that sense of acceptance and validation from one's community. I mean, this is the psychodynamic driver behind it. And ultimately, the solution for that is a spiritual one. It truly is. It is an individual who has a real healthy sense of self and at peace with himself in relation with their creator would be somewhat resilient, not necessarily totally, but somewhat resilient if they're actually not afraid of what other people think of them because they're at peace with who they are. But that also then comes not just from Bible reading. It comes from healthy parenting.
Yeah. Well, and let's just be real honest. Parents are the worst with their phones. We have taken, prior to age two, we have taken 2,000 photos and videos of our kids. So I get calls all the time from mothers of 12-year-olds that just gave them a phone And they're like, I think she's addicted to her phone. I can't get her off her phone. She keeps taking 75 duck face selfies and posting one. I don't understand it. And I'm like, well, let's talk about your behavior on your phone. Are you somebody who documents her every move and then posts it on Facebook to get validation yourself? And most of the time, the answer is yes. And so if we're really honest, this starts with us. The takeaway message for this generation is everywhere I go, my parents are going to document how awesome I am and then post it and get their own likes, validation, and comments. And so going back to the drivers psychologically, the attachment need of wanting to be seen, heard, and loved is not only a parental attachment need online, but also a child attachment need online. If you're not getting that attachment and attunement in your home, social media, pornography, video games is a great place to get seen, heard, and loved. And so I talk a lot in my keynote speeches about let's put the devices aside and this underbelly that we're talking about today. You know, what is driving kids to need this validation? They're watching parents do it. Moms is not often dads, but moms are the worst. And, you know, when I say this and my audience is that heads are nodding, tears are coming down their face. They're like, holy cow, I created this.
And so if a mother in your audience has that epiphany, where do they go from there? What is the solution?
Yeah, I mean, my encouragement to them is if you are able to be honest with yourself about your own tech habits, perhaps we go to Disneyland and we take two photos with Mickey. And if Caden, your son, doesn't want to smile, we move on. And we have spent thousands of dollars to go to Disneyland to enjoy it. Put the phone away. Like, we have lost our minds and our kids are watching our every move. When I speak to students, I usually speak like to students during the school day. And I'm like, I'm going to see your parents tonight. Is there anything you want me to tell them? All the hands go up and they're like, tell my dad to get off his laptop and Bitcoin and Candy Crush and tell my mom to get off Instagram.
Interesting.
Yeah. So in my opinion, it starts with us. And that is the title of my keynote is Parenting in a Tech World. It starts with us.
So as an expert in this field, and you mentioned Bark earlier, grateful for that. We were able to use that software to get our girls slowly moved. They're not quite to, you know, 100% involvement yet, but it's that overwatch that it provides, things like that, you know, barriers, and you can put, you know, different safeguards in place for notifications. What are some of the best practices you've found for, I mean, obviously getting off the devices, that's wonderful, but also some of us have requirements for jobs that we have to be connected to our phones. We have to be able like to be on call. We have to be, how do we put safeguards in place in all of our lives as far as like helping our children get involved, what we can do, but like what technology is available for families and what are some of the best practices you found with that to find that happy medium? Because you can't go to one extreme and say, oh, we're never using our technology again because it's the world we live in. But we also don't want to go to the other extreme of that's where we live is constantly on our devices. So how do we find that middle ground?
I think one of the things that I always recommend is having a central charging station in your home where all devices go. So there is that tech-free zone. I'm a big fan of not allowing kids to have their phones out in the car, like, you know, having at least one day a week, tech-free Tuesday, where nobody's on their phone, we're having conversations, we're driving to soccer practice, learning about each other, having that back and forth conversation. And I think the central charging station also allows the whole family to get really good sleep. So we use a router called Griffon, G-R-Y-P-H-O-N, that allows our family to have like zone 1, 2, and 3 goes off at 9:30 p.m. So the girls don't have access to Wi-Fi. All devices are on a central charging station. So the sleep factor, I mean, and we'll talk about this probably in another segment about the impact of sleep on mental health. And that's a big, huge one for all of us. I mean, how many adults are sleeping with their phone next to them, wake up at 3 a.m. to go to the bathroom, and then you just start scrolling? And so it's not just a kid problem.
That's really a thing?
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Having a central charging station and your router. Your router will do a lot of the work for you. You can put restrictions on it. You can,
I like that idea of the router a lot where it shuts down at certain hours. It's really great.
But on your own phone, if you, obviously, our financial livelihoods are on our phone. And so going grayscale on your phone, the blue light will not come through on the grayscale as much. Taking, you know, Danielle took social media off her phone. Like, not having things that are distracting on your phone is a great first step. It's difficult to do, but it's possible.
I guess it's easy for me since I never done it. No, I have a phone and I use it for telephone. I use it for my airline app to get on my airline and things like this. And I also use it for books. I read books on there. And some texting, I don't even like to text. I rarely send a text from my phone. I will get them, but I will like to get to my computer to respond back because I can type. Yeah. And so I don't like to do it. But I have one other thought, though. I was thinking about what you said a moment ago related to the kids saying about the parents, get off the phone. Well, I didn't grow up in an era. This is kind of a question whether it really is the phone or whether it is parental engagement, because I didn't grow up in an era we had cell phones. But I remember coming home at the end of the day, it was school, or my dad would go in and watch football or baseball or basketball, and he would be on the TV, and he'd sit there in front of the TV, wouldn't come out and play ball with us, and he wouldn't do stuff with us. And if you asked me, I'd say, would you get him to turn off the TV? But he didn't have a device. So dynamically, for me, it seems very similar to what the parents are doing. So is it really the device, or is it the fact of parental disengagement for their own parental entertainment?
Yeah, I think that's a very good point, because it is similar. It's the same, in my opinion, now that you outline that. And that was very much how my household went as well. And my grandparents were glued to the TV.
And maybe so. Here's the difference. Maybe here's the difference. When I grew up, we had one TV in the house with three primary networks and a couple of UHF channels. I don't know if you're right. And you actually had to walk across the room to change channel. No, it's true. That's the era I grew up in. So if Dad was watching his program on TV, I couldn't watch Cartoon Network or whatever. There was no network, but cartoons. Okay. So we had to go out and play.
Yeah. That's
Whereas today, if the parents are on their device, they might not be engaging, but the child has their own device or their own TV in another room. And so they, rather than going out and playing, are digitally engaging and changing their brain circuitry and all this other stuff, because they defer to their own digital platforms, whether it's television, video games, or whatever it might be. Whereas in my day, that wasn't available as an option. So you actually went out and played, which helped the brain develop better. So I'm wondering if it's a twofold. Parents are still doing the parental entertainment, but the kids now have access to stuff other than play.
And dinner. Did you eat dinner together?
Sometimes not. It wasn't consistent in my upbringing. If there's a ball game on, he's eating dinner watching the ball game.
Yeah. I fly a lot and I'm in restaurants a lot, and a lot of even just families are just, they're all head down on a device at dinner. So that mirroring that FaceTime with each other in real life, I find is not as prevalent.
Any other thing on this topic you want to follow up on?
Well, one of the things that I'm curious from your professional perspective, one of the things I started noticing, I was in education years ago, but one of the things I started noticing was that students were no longer able to articulate well. Public speaking was a struggle. And one of the things that I have often wondered is it connected to the fact that, like, even I'm guilty of this, don't call me, text me. You know, that my communication is much faster if I can just get to a text message, but I can write that out. I can think about it I can edit it with, Grammarly or something. Is there a connection to kids today's ability to communicate and critically think in real time now that they have all of these media apps and technology that they don't have to be in the spotlight having that conversation with somebody because they're so used to just sending a virtual reply? Whether that's a text or a snap or anything like that.
Yeah. I've found that academically they're genius, right? But when they get into these conversations with each other, they struggle to articulate. They struggle when there's a conflict with a friendship. My daughter is 18, she's a freshman in college, and she's like, Mom, I was Snapchatting with this kid for like 2 weeks. He finally asked me out on a date. We went to get crumble cookies, and like the kid can't hold a conversation in real life. Like, he was fantastic on Snapchat. We were talking, but in real life, like, he couldn't even hold a conversation. And so I find that a lot with, like, the social competence around when there's an issue at school, whether it's harassment, intimidation, or just low-level conflict, mean, annoying, and rude, they are much more apt to get on a device and spew venom and say awful things to each other than they are having to articulate that in person. Like, hey, why'd you say that about me? Or why'd you do that in the locker room? Or what's going on? Like, they don't have any practice doing this back and forth.
And that's because communication, as you're pointing this out, the devices allow for, you might just call, cognitive communication, text or fact or word communication. But real interpersonal communication has not only the verbal words that are saying, but all of the connotation, the emotional connection, the dynamic elements of facial expression, empathy. There are mirror neurons involved. There is the anticipation of a reprisal or response. There's so much more that goes on. And the way our brains are, as in one of the laws of our life, is if you want something to get stronger, you must exercise it, because if you don't use it, you lose it. And so what you're describing are individuals who've never actually practiced these skills. And so their neural circuits are actually very atrophied in their capacity to engage in this way. And then they will get social stress or anxiety on the date. And it's like, then they isolate. And this is what we're finding in this generation, that young men are much more likely to get involved in porn because it's safer than to get involved with a girl. And because they haven't developed these skills, because they're used to doing it digitally, where there's actually no interpersonal emotional processing in real time going on.
Well, and on the front of pornography, in the, you know, this kind of relationship building, the baseline for intimacy is so way off. Like, my girls are experiencing boys who are expecting a lot out of them very quickly, and that's a whole other topic. But on that front, you know, this dating thing, it's not dating anymore. It's hooking up. And my girls have really struggled with that because they don't want to engage in that way. They want to be courted. They want to date. They want to hang out. My daughter, who's a college freshman, you know, we went down for parents weekend, and I was like, I couldn't believe the kind of behavior that I saw just, you know, across campus with how young men were talking about girls and sort of catcalling. Certainly not all of them, but I was paying very close attention to just the interactions in between them. And a lot of that is coming from the pornography, which is baked into apps like Snapchat, Instagram, and TikTok.
You know, so any closing comments about suggestions for parents to help with their adolescents in this, other than keep them off of it? We've said keep them off. Parents' involvement. Any other thoughts? Any other closing comments?
Well, I love the idea of learning. You know, one of the things I'm familiar with some, but not all, because I, to protect myself, haven't gotten a Snapchat account. You know, I don't want a TikTok because I don't want to get caught up in the, you know, the doom scrolling, the dopamine drive. Like, it's like, it, to me, it's like a slot machine, right? You know, you get on that, you start getting these videos, it makes your brain feel good. But I need to learn more about that. One of the things that I have appreciated is, if you learn about it, you know, is the controls that are on technology now. Like, one of the things we do with our girls, similar, I love the idea of the just turning the internet off, but we have certain time limits that at a certain time of night, their phones are programmed to only contact me or my wife. So if there is an emergency, they can reach out to us, but they can't get on the internet. They can't get on social media. It just becomes a phone at that point. So that's been very helpful for us. But we had to learn those things about what the phones can and can't do to put those in place.
And I think that what you're saying there, parents need to remember, until their children are emancipated, those devices are the parents.
Mm-hmm.
And the parents pay for those devices. The parents pay for the accounts on those devices. And the parents can set the parameters for the use of those devices. And I know a lot of the patients that I see where the parents, you know, feel like, and the young people, even when the young people are in college, the parents are still paying for this. The parents can still set those parameters if they want. And there's often a lot of tension where the parents are not doing this. And I think that's a parental responsibility. They need to step back in and decide intelligently in the same way that an employer actually decides for employees on the devices that the employer owns, that the employees are using. They will set parameters on the use of those devices. Parents need to recognize and take that ownership. And then if the kids complain, they simply say, when you're an adult and you buy your own devices and pay for your own subscriptions and services, then you can set the parameters on the devices that you want. But right now, these are my devices. If you want to use my devices, these are the parameters. Or you don't have to use them. You'll find they'll back off real quick.
And I think that's like the theme is technology in our home. Technology is a privilege, not a right. And we made that very clear up front. Like, you have to be pulling your pillars of wellness in the world. Your sleep has to be good. Your hygiene, your grades, your behavior. If any of those things are tanking, you don't get the privilege of using your device. And there are families, as you well know, where a 9-year-old is like running the show.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's dysfunctional. I like what you said there, that it is a privilege, and it's a privilege for the mature, and the mature earn that privilege by demonstrating fulfillment of all their life obligations that are appropriate for their age level at that time. Well said. Well, Katie, thank you for joining us today for this topic, and thank you all for being part of this program. If you have questions, send those in to designformore.net, designformore.net, and we'll see you on our next program. Thank you so much.
Thank you for joining us on Designed for More, brought to you by Come and Reason Ministries and Honey Lake Clinic. Also, don't forget to check out our other podcasts for more inspiring content.